Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Ferris, Texas is located just southeast of the city of Dallas. A tiny sliver of Ferris's north end, in fact, is in Dallas County, the rest in Ellis County. The small town's humble beginnings go back to the early 1850s when the area, nestled between Ten Mile Creek and Bear Creek, was settled by two families who came from Rutherford County, Tennessee. Settling the bleak and untamed prairie was no easy task, and the families lost several young children to the harsh conditions there in the first several years. It was the arrival of the railroad in the early 1870s that more or less saved the day for the community. Just a few years before that, a large group from Mississippi, about 13 families, arrived in the area, and it had grown enough by then to bring Jackson J. Straw to town to build and operate a general merchandise store. In 1874, Waxahachie Judge Justice Wesley Ferris handled the necessary formalities of a transaction to build a railroad depot, which consisted of the Tennessee Transplants deeding around 100 acres to the Houston and Texas Central Railroad Company. Either as payment for his work or out of tribute, it isn't clear, the area was named after the judge and called Ferris from that point on. Now, the railroad there had already been completed months before the transaction was complete. It ran right through Ferris to Dallas from Corsicana. The owner of the general store there had already been declared postmaster, and a mercantile store, a hotel, the Citizens National Bank, and, of course, a church, Presbyterian, were all long established by then. It was the couple years that followed, however, that brought what the town needed to really grow: a furniture company, an artesian well, a cotton gin, and the true sign that something worthwhile was brewing there, a newspaper, the Ferris Cyclone. Interestingly, in less than a decade, that newspaper would be sold twice and renamed the Ferris Sentinel first, and then the Ferris Wheel. On July 15, 1901, the Ferris Town Council voted to abolish its former incorporation as the Town of Ferris. Since they now met the criteria handed down by the state of Texas to be considered a city, Ferris reincorporated as the City of Ferris. By 1914, there were six brick production plants in operation in Ferris, and the brick capital of the nation, or the city that bricked the world, grew in population more than it would in the history of its existence. Compared to many small cities surrounding the vast metropolis that is Dallas, Ferris, Texas, is still small, with plenty of rural area, and it is relatively untouched by big city crime. Even the infamous highway that runs directly through Ferris, Interstate 45, has yet to taint the well below average crime rate of the tiny city. But a brutal yet methodical double murder in March of 2009, the slayings of Janine Johnson and Stephen Taylor, put Ferris on the map in the worst of ways.
Thank you.
Janine Lynn Johnson was born in Tarrant County, Texas, on September 1, 1979, to parents Diana and John Johnson. She attended South Grand Prairie High School, and at age 17, after giving birth to a boy months before, she married. She and her first husband's marriage ended after a little less than 2 years, but they remained close friends and co-parents. Janine Johnson was friendly, and her intelligence, warm heart, and her energy and enthusiasm for life were all aspects of her character that drew people to her. Her love life, however, took a while to catch on. By the time she was 28 years old, Janine had married and divorced a few more times. She maintained extremely close and personal relationships with all of her exes, even after they went their separate ways. That's who Janine was. She didn't stop caring for folks simply because a romance fizzled out. Once you were Janine Johnson's friend, there was no way out. You were drawn to her, and she to you. One of her exes, in fact, continued to help Janine out financially whenever she needed it long after they divorced. All she had to do was ask. That's the effect Janine had on people, and the feeling was reciprocal with everyone she knew. She was always there for her friends and family. Janine Lynn Johnson was smart, happy, optimistic, and felt genuine concern for her loved ones. When Janine met Stephen, who quickly developed a close bond with her son Chris, her love life began looking up. Stephen Glenn Taylor was born to parents Tendall and Gloria Taylor on January 12, 1970, in McKinney, a historic Texas city in Collin County that has come to serve the behemoth city of Dallas as a northern suburban outlier. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about Stephen Taylor, aside from the fact that once he and Janine Johnson began seeing each other, it took no time for him to become not only a strong father figure to her son Chris, but also a close friend. Chris later called Stephen one of the best men he's ever known. Stephen Taylor, we do know, was involved with the local youth, and, being that he was good at the game, was known as a hell of a softball coach to the kids. It's not for a lack of trying that his background is difficult to nail down. Both he and Janine were fairly low-key and family-oriented folks, particularly after they began creating their own family unit, and neither of them had criminal backgrounds or even any interaction with law enforcement at all, not anywhere they lived, including Ferris, where, in March of 2009, they lived. The couple were friends with neighbors, but Janine, her mother later commented, was mostly a homebody. Janine was said to keep tabs on the neighborhood goings-on, but rarely left the house. She was content at home. She was friendly with everyone, but she was introverted and preferred concentrating on her family. Janine was relatively new in Ferris, but Stephen had been around for quite some time and knew plenty of his fellow residents. He was well-liked, even by Ferris's mayor, in fact, who'd known him for several years. They were just normal folks who did their own thing and kept to themselves and enjoyed their lives in the low-key town of Ferris. The small city had around 2,900 residents in 2009 and was known for being quiet and safe. One March night of that year, however, it was anything but that, at least for Stephen and Janine. While keeping unsolved cases alive and in the light is the challenge that Erica and I are most passionate about, there was a point not long ago where I needed something else that would give me a good challenge while taking my mind off of true crime here and there. I wanted a mobile matching puzzle game, but not the same old, same old. I needed something that offered more than just the same basic strategy over and over again. Just when I thought the search for such a thing was hopeless, I stumbled upon Best Fiends, the game that always refreshes the old gray matter. Best Fiends is more than just smashing candy. Every level presents a new challenging puzzle, with its own goals, obstacles, and sometimes things to help you along. I haven't been able to put down the game since I started well over a year ago, and even at level 3716, Best Fiends continues to present fresh puzzles and new events. The cool little characters and bright colors keep it fun, too. So, if you've had trouble finding a puzzle game that's more than just blowing up cupcakes or whatever, give Best Fiends a go. As always, if you get hooked, go ahead and blame me. I can take it. Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
On the evening of Sunday, March 21st, 2009, until around 8 p.m., Janine Johnson and Stephen Taylor played softball with a local team, and the following morning, they were to meet back up with them for another game. They didn't make it, however, and the couple wasn't answering or returning phone calls. Stephen's brother became worried and decided to head over to Stephen and Janine's place to see what was going on. At the home, located on the 400 block of South Church Street, both Janine and Stephen's cars sat parked, but there was no answer to his brother's knocks. It wasn't a matter of someone inside not hearing. Stephen's brother's knocks eventually escalated to more of a heavy pounding. The doors were locked, so he began peeking through and pounding on windows around the house. When he came to one window, the master bedroom was in his view, and he saw legs, but absolutely nothing moved. He pounded more when he knew someone was there, but still, no movement. Something, he knew, was terribly wrong. Other family members were on the scene with Stephen's brother, and after receiving no answer for several minutes, one of them saw a City of Ferris Public Works vehicle passing by, and they flagged it down. The driver was asked to call police to Stephen and Janine's home. At 1:26 p.m. on Sunday, March 22, 2009, the Ferris police were dispatched. They arrived at 1:30. Ferris Police Department officers and family members walked the outside of the home, pulling on windows, trying to find one that wasn't locked. Finally, after many attempts, they were able to raise one. A family member crawled through and went straight to the front door to unlock the house. The cops went in, and what they found was horrifying, a massacre. On their bed laid Janine Lynn Johnson and Stephen Glenn Taylor, bloody and lifeless. Later, after investigators carefully surveyed the double murder scene, Justice of the Peace Jackie Miller Jr. was called in. Miller, who had served Ellis County for 12 years at that point, called the scene the most gruesome he'd ever witnessed before pronouncing the couple dead at 5:13 p.m. The bodies were taken to the Dallas County Medical Examiner's office shortly thereafter. The autopsies of Stephen Taylor and Janine Johnson revealed a terrible death for the couple, their slayings the work of a depraved and callous killer. Both had been stabbed repeatedly with a medium-length blade knife, about 5 inches long. Though they'd been attacked while they slept, never having left the bed, Both Janine and Stephen had many defensive wounds on their arms and hands. Janine was stabbed more than 4 dozen times, and Stephen more than 20. One of the stab wounds Stephen sustained severed the nerves in his spine, leaving him paralyzed, still alive after the wounds were inflicted, but unable to move. Eventually, he bled to death as the result of a severed artery in the groin area. While the Ferris police commented that they believed Stephen and Janine were killed sometime between midnight and 1:26 p.m. on that day in March, since officers arrived at the home at 1:30 p.m. and family was there before that, it's likely they have the couple's time of death estimated a little tighter than that. Ferris police investigator Walter Weiss said that there were no signs of forced entry at any entryway or window. Though they finally did gain entry into Janine and Stephen's home through a window, the detective commented that it did not appear that anyone else had entered there. No one who had a key to the home had lost theirs. The keyholes were thoroughly inspected under magnification for signs that the locks had been picked, but unfortunately they were well worn by normal unlocking, so determining whether or not a lock pick had been used was impossible. The police said they didn't find any unidentified tire tracks, and no shoe or boot prints that would suggest that the perpetrator had entered through a window. The murders of Janine, the mother of an 11-year-old boy at the time, and Stephen, who had become so close to her boy, left friends and neighbors in disbelief. They had no idea who'd have done such a thing to the normal, unassuming couple. Their families were crushed. The cops were stumped. Since the crime was so brutal, it took the Ferris Police Department days to thoroughly inspect the scene and collect evidence. The manner in which Stephen and Janine were killed, and including whatever details they're holding back, led detectives to believe that the double murder was carried out carefully and methodically. They expounded some on why they believed that to be true, but we'll get back to that. During the course of processing the murder scene, investigators and officers visited neighboring homes to try and eke out a witness. No one in the area had reported anything to police that night, neither by 911 or by any other means, but the step, anyway, was a necessary one. Across the street from Janine Johnson and Stephen Taylor lived another couple, a man and a woman. Both told detectives that the night of the slayings, a vehicle pulled into their driveway. They knew right away it was their drive because how their house was positioned relative to the driveway, the vehicle's lights shined directly into a window of the home. The woman in the house noticed, but she didn't pay it much mind. Her husband, however, went outside to see what was going on. The vehicle that pulled into their driveway then pulled out and drove off, according to this man. He got a good look at the driver, he told detectives, and said the vehicle was a Dodge or Chrysler van. The man had heard a scream that night, too, he added. The lead was promising. A witness was a good first step. After bringing in a sketch artist from out of town, a composite drawing of the man in the van was created. But the whole lead fell apart when the Ferris police were told that the man giving this information had mental health issues as well as substance abuse issues. He was prone to lying, apparently, and was lying about this. And not long after giving the police false information, the man's life spiraled out of control. His wife found drugs in the house and booted him out. She divorced him not long after that, and he ended up in prison. This lead, the only potential witness the cops came up with, was a dead end. The man, according to them, could not be considered reliable. While they found the wife credible, she never got up to see what type of vehicle had pulled into her driveway, let alone the driver. The Ferris police combed area trash bins in residential areas and dumpsters at businesses for discarded bloody clothing or bloody anything but came up empty-handed. Back at the scene of the double murder, after the entirety of the home had been processed, it appeared that the killer had left absolutely nothing behind. There was no murder weapon to be found, and, as we alluded to before, the cops found the terrible crime to have been carried out carefully and methodically. They had good reason to believe this. In the master bedroom where Jeanine Johnson and Stephen Taylor were brutally slain, attacked as they slept, blood was everywhere. It covered the bed and spatter was on the floor and walls. However, investigators working the crime scene didn't find any blood outside of the master bedroom, not a single drop. Ferris Police Investigator Walter Weiss commented that he found that detail particularly alarming, as if Jeanine and Stephen's killer knew what they were doing from experience. Somehow they committed this unthinkably heinous act that no doubt rendered them covered in blood, but tracked that blood nowhere beyond that room. It was, if detectives hadn't seen it with their own eyes, unbelievable. The fact that not a drop of blood could be found outside the room Stephen Taylor and Jeanine Johnson were found, stabbed to death, on their bed, was hardly the only detail that baffled investigators. The motive for these egregious murders, these overkills, was just as elusive as clues. Not only was there no blood outside the master bedroom, but also the rest of the home was undisturbed. It hadn't been ransacked or even rifled through. Nothing appeared to be stolen, not even the gold chain around Jeanine's neck. In fact, Ferris Police Investigator Walter Weiss told the press everything in the house, the slangs notwithstanding, of course, looked perfectly normal. With that in mind and the lack of evidence of forced entry, detectives surmised that robbery or a burglary gone wrong was not the motive. Instead, they believed Jeanine and Stephen knew their killer or killers. The issue of why they were killed, however, was difficult to resolve. The couple was relatively quiet, had no criminal records, and there wasn't any evidence of drug deals gone bad or anything else that might explain such a methodical and seemingly calculated double murder. The Dallas County Medical Examiner told investigators that they believed there was a good chance that there were two killers involved in the double murder. At autopsy, it appeared to the medical examiner that the stab wounds were inflicted using two different shaped blades. They did not, however, specify whether they meant that the weapon used to inflict Stephen's wounds was different than the weapon used to inflict Jeanine's wounds, or if both Stephen and Jeanine had wounds inflicted by two separate weapons. Also, it seems hard to ignore that Jeanine was stabbed more than twice as many times as Stephen, but that particular detail is never discussed in reports. In fact, it should be noted that some recent reports claim that Stephen was actually stabbed over 70 times. This makes it hard to determine who was the main target of the slayings, and is only relevant anyway, most likely, if the crime was personal. Which, of course, we don't know, but it seems unlikely. We'll get to a theory that seems far more plausible here in a minute. One thing was clear to detectives. These slayings were not random. When word got around town, the Ferris police were inundated with calls from locals providing tips. Even folks from Wilmer, a little town just north of Ferris, called in claiming to have information. Investigator Walter Weiss commented that none of these tips led anywhere. When detectives got these people to the station, in virtually every case, it turned out the tipsters actually had little or no information that could help them. But there was one man who visited Ferris Police Headquarters to provide interesting information. This man lived near Stephen Taylor and Jeanine Johnson, and he wondered if what happened to them was meant for him instead. He told detectives that he was to testify at a federal court trial, and perhaps The killer or killers of the couple got the address wrong and botched the hit, killing Janine and Steven when it was meant for him. There was certainly cause to entertain the theory. For one, the cops commented from the get-go that the slang appears to have been carried out by someone who knew what they were doing. Someone, they theorized, who'd done this kind of terrible thing before, like perhaps a hitman. But that's probably not the only reason. We don't have all the information to suggest that the following is a thing, but it's potentially interesting. Though his exact address isn't mentioned in reports, this man lived on North Church Street. Stephen and Janine lived on South Church Street, on the 400 block. There is only one 400 address on North Church Street. There are a total of four 400 addresses on South Church Street, one of which has the same number as the only 400 address on North Church Street. Though we do not know the name of this man who came forward with this information, there is a man who lived at both the only 400 address on North Church Street and the same number address on South Church Street, which is where Janine and Steven lived. Now, I want to be clear that we don't know if that information is in any way relevant. It was simply something interesting I came across that I thought I'd share. Whatever the case, the Ferris police told the media that they had no evidence whatsoever to connect the murders of Janine Johnson and Steven Taylor to this possible case of mistaken identity, and the lead remains little more than a theory. Whether Janine and Steven's murders were a case of a botched attempt to silence a witness in a federal court case, or something else entirely, Ferris police investigator Walter Weiss is certain that more than one individual perpetrated the crime. He told reporters that if he got a confession from a person who said they committed the slangs by themselves, he'd be extremely doubtful of that admission. If two people were involved, perhaps, it's more likely that someone somewhere has information that would lead to an arrest. Investigator Weiss has made several pleas to the public, asking that the right person come forward.
"Somebody knows something," Weiss says. "Somebody knows a lot. There are so many unanswered questions that are left. The answers are out there somewhere."
Early on in the initial investigation, Investigator Weiss reached out to the Dallas County Sheriff's Office, the Ellis County Sheriff's Office, and the Texas Rangers for assistance. Still, the murders of Janine Johnson and Steven Taylor remain unsolved. It wasn't only the lack of evidence that stifled the progress of the investigation into the murders of Janine and Steven. According to the current Ferris Police Chief, relentless changes of personnel throughout the department since 2009 are partly to blame. Not only have the Ferris Police seen a rotation of three chiefs in that time, the detectives, too, were reassigned or left for other prospects. That left whoever was newly assigned to the double murder to start from scratch. The entire case file and the evidence associated had to be reviewed again each time. The case's original investigator, Walter Weiss, left the Ferris Police Department in January 2020. As did commissioned cold case investigator Bob Alward, who'd been working Janine and Steven's case for 2 years. In 2018, the Ferris Police presented the case to the Sheriff's Association of Texas's Cold Case Review Squad in Austin. Sometimes all it takes is a fresh set of eyes to uncover potential new evidence, and that's exactly what happened. Upon review of the photographic murder scene evidence, the squad noticed something about an item of clothing that Janine Johnson was wearing. Described as simply an item, they suggested that the Ferris Police submit it for testing. The department pored over the files and came to realize that the item in question had not undergone DNA analysis. The item was sent to the Southwest Institute of Forensic Sciences in Dallas. Because of advances in DNA science since 2009, Other evidence that has already been tested too has the chance of providing something new. Both Ferris Police Chief Eddie Salazar and investigator Walter Weiss are optimistic about these new possibilities. And beyond that, Weiss commented in 2018 that information about what happened has recently come to light. These new sources of information, he says, have the department hopeful about their prospects to finally solve this double murder. On the day after the bodies of Stephen and Janine were found, her 11-year-old son Chris returned to his father's home from school to a house full of grieving family. None of them told the boy what was happening. Chris later said that he was told to do his homework and wait till his father returned home. When he saw his mother the day before she and Stephen were slain, Chris said he had, quote, one of those gut feelings that something bad was going to happen, but didn't know who or when, end quote. Chris's father arrived home later and told his son the news. Since he had just seen his mom, the news was unbelievable, but, of course, devastating. It is difficult to imagine much worse than an 11-year-old losing their mother to a senseless and brutal act of violence, and also Stephen, who Chris called his best friend. Stephen Taylor's parents had both passed away before he and Janine Johnson were violently murdered by a coward who struck as they slept. The afternoon that his daughters and Stephen's bodies were found, Janine's father, John Johnson, got a call from his brother-in-law. At first, John said he thought it was a joke. The stage of grief known as denial immediately kicked in, perhaps, as a defense mechanism. He just couldn't understand it. Stephen and Janine didn't have any enemies. There wasn't even any aspect of their lives in which enemies can be made. Diana, Janine's mother, got the news shortly thereafter. She had just gotten home from the grocery store, where she stopped off after leaving work. As John began telling his wife about their daughter and her boyfriend, a story was running about the double murder on the television behind him. The press knew before them, Janine's parents. They were, of course, riddled with grief, and the subsequent years have not mended the wound. They want justice for Janine and Stephen, accountability for the person or persons who so callously and senselessly committed these crimes. The Ferris police say they are committed to solving this case and implore the public to come forward with information. They'll go anywhere they need to speak with anyone who has information, and they welcome that information too through calls, emails, or a visit to the police station located at 111 Ewing Boulevard in Ferris. Should you have information, you can call the Ferris police at 972-544-2225, or you can remain anonymous by calling the Ellis County Crime Stoppers hotline at 972-937-7297. Gone Cold will be in Austin June 4th through 6th at this year's CrimeCon. Erica and I would love to meet y'all, so if you plan on attending, please be sure to stop by our table on Podcast Row and say hi. If you're planning on buying a ticket, you can use the promo code COLD for 10% off the admission price. Hope to see y'all there. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as Dr. Dreadful and the Coed Killer, among others. The latest exclusive will be up soon. I apologize for the delay. Thanks so much to everyone who supports us there. We couldn't do this without you, and we appreciate your help. If you'd like to help provide answers for the families of unsolved crime victims from all over, or maybe help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company like Ancestry or 23andMe to their database. We'll provide a link in the show notes. FerrisTexas.gov, The Story of Ferris, Texas by Judge Grace C. McKnight, the Waxahachie Daily Light, and the Dallas Morning News were used as sources for this episode. Thanks for listening, y'all.